Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, the 19th of May in 2008, and on this day, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, was released. You know what year Star Wars Episode I? Keep in mind the way Star Wars worked. George Lucas did what we thought was Star Wars 1, 2, and 3, and it turns out they were Star Wars 4, 5, and 6. So they went back to the prequels. So Episode 1 was actually the fourth Star Wars movie that he put out. He released it on this date in 1999, The Phantom Menace. But also, 2005, just 2 years ago, he released the last, well, Episode 3 it's called, Revenge of the Sith. And of course, Revenge of the Sith was not, it's probably the least well-received, but it was the sixth Star Wars movie, and I think then he announced, at some point he announced he wasn't going to make the last three of them, that six would be enough. And so we probably are never going to see the last three. You wonder how the story ends. Could good possibly triumph over evil or not? I think we know the answer to that. In any case, it is also on May 19th, the birthday of Joey Ramone of the Ramones from the world of music, and Pete Townshend, lead guitarist and songwriter and smart guy from The Who. And as my regular listeners know, my favorite rock performer of all time, bar none. So once again, today is May 19th, and on the breaks, we'll listen to a little of Pete Townshend's solo work. But for now, there's more information coming out about the New England Patriots and the taping that they did. And it turns out that the video assistant, Matt Walsh, said in a TV interview, he was their video assistant, that he believes that the Patriots got, quote, a significant competitive advantage from being able to diagnose or understand opponents' play signals throughout the tenure of Bill Belichick there. Of course, they won Super Bowls in this time. And at first they said, it wasn't that big a deal. It turns out knowing what the other side's going to do is a big help. Who'd have thunk it? Also, in the world of music and concerts, I almost went to a show last week at Nissan, and I'm so glad I didn't. I ended up being exhausted. I had a long day. It was final exam week, and I was doing a lot of grading and things like that. But Radiohead appeared at Nissan, and I was tempted to go see him. It turns out I'm lucky I didn't. It was raining, of course, so I would have had to scalp a seat in the seats, and I always do. I never sit on the lawn. Very, very rarely do I sit on the lawn. But seats are more expensive when the people on the lawn are getting drenched. In any case, here's a quote from Tim Shaw of Clarksville, Maryland. Quote, I wasted almost 8 hours of my life trying to get to Nissan Pavilion and driving back home. He got to the venue at 10:30 p.m. when the concert was nearly over, and he turned around at the gate. Quote, I've been to a lot of shows and a lot of festivals, including the second Woodstock, and I've never seen anything as insane. Another fan said it took him 4 hours to go 35 miles before they gave up at 10 o'clock. 35 miles. I guess he's talking about, from Silver Springs. He's talking about the Beltway and everything else. Well, yeah, rush hour at the Beltway is a problem. You want to get up there before rush hour. In the same way, if I leave Northern Virginia and I want to go to see Meriwether Post to see something, as I will this summer for a couple of shows, REM is playing up there, Alison Krauss and Robert Plant are playing up there. I'm not going to wait till 6 o'clock or 5:30 to try and tackle Beltway traffic. So some of this may be amateur night for these folks, but also you have just got to get it straightened out. People complain about Nissan as being one of the worst venues in the country to get in and out of. That's not been my experience of it. Of course, I only live 30 minutes away from it. But you got to know how to go in the back way. And when I say the back way, there's only two ways. It's the second way. And there's traffic there frequently. But I've only once have I ever gone in the, quote, front way, the main entrance. Always go the other way. A survey came out last week, and it turns out that Washington drivers are still among the rudest drivers in the United States. It's the third annual Auto Vantage Road Rage Survey, and we are fifth this year, just as we were last year, in road rage. That is, we are among the least courteous cities in America. And if you're interested in what the most road rage is, the least courteous cities, the hostility index that they compute, the top 10 are, starting at number one, Miami's the worst for road rage or courtesy on the part of drivers. Boston is second. New York is third. Baltimore is fourth. Washington, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Phoenix, and then Dallas and Tampa are tied for number 9 and 10. The most courteous cities, the cities with the least road rage, you might be surprised at this list. Starting at the top, the best. Pittsburgh, Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Sacramento, Chicago, San Diego, and San Francisco. So it's a little bit deceptive in that you might think that, well, let's see, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, these are Midwest, you know, industrial cities. You wouldn't think people would be real friendly there or whatever. Whereas California cities, you know, like San Diego, Sacramento, or Seattle and Portland, you figure, life's laid back out on the West Coast. Maybe the drivers are nicer. Not exactly, because Los Angeles is on the top 10 in road rage, too. But, of course, the cities with the worst traffic have the most road rage in general. When we talk New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and Washington, those are four of the worst cities for traffic as well. So what you really need is a ratio of traffic to road rage. In other news, out in California, as the governor pronounces it, there is a ruling that made news last week. The state Supreme Court overturned the ban on same-sex marriage that had been passed. And so California has joined Massachusetts in allowing marriage licenses for gay partners. Now, this is a state Supreme Court that did this. It's a state court. It wasn't the California Supreme Court that did it. So it's very possible this will be overturned. We will see. They're going to try and get a ballot initiative, conservatives and Republicans are, to get this overturned. And, of course, that the advantage of these ballot initiatives, as was proven in 2004 and 2006, is it helps bring values voters, conservative value voters out to the polls, because they come out to vote for the initiative and then they stay to vote for, in this case, John McCain is the thinking, I'm sure. So we'll see how that goes. Apparently, Arnold Schwarzenegger is not going to fight it. That is, he's going to accept the ruling on the part of the judge as opposed to taking them to court, which the state is within its right to do, to try and appeal and make sure they get a decision from the state Supreme Court, get it overturned, or just get it finalized if that's what they wanted. Schwarzenegger's not going to do that. And I've not read enough about it to know why and what the implications of that are, if that's political reality, if that is him accepting the decision, as I heard a conservative talk show host say today, or if it's simply him saying, let's leave it for the initiative in the fall. I don't know for sure. Here's an interesting story. There is an athlete trying to make it to the Olympics on the U.S. Olympic teams, and his name is Oscar Pistorius, I guess is how you pronounce his name. He is he's handicapped. He had both legs amputated before he was 1 year old. 1 year old. And he uses these springs kinds of things, spring feet, attached to, I guess, just below the knee, what he's got left of his leg. And it's kind of like the back legs of a cheetah or any big cat, right? They bend a particular direction.
unlike human legs, which, you know, bend the way dogs and cats' front legs bend only. Well, the question was, does he get an unfair advantage as a runner running on artificial legs because there's spring in his step that the average runner doesn't have? And I just thought that was hilarious on one level. That is, he's handicapped. He has no legs, and you're talking unfair advantage. But then when I saw the apparatus he runs with, it struck me that, well, maybe you could get an advantage with this. I guess the acid test would be to take a regular athlete and have him put on a pair of these, make him a little taller, but see if he could improve his speed or his stamina or whatever. My guess is no, that a regular runner could not improve, which would lend credence to the notion that he does not get an unfair advantage from these spring legs. But beyond that, I think what's interesting about it is that there was a decision made that he can now compete for a spot in the Olympics. Okay, and so it'll be interesting to see whether he can make the Olympic team. Okay, but he has set world records for Paralympics, right? For these are top athletes who have disabilities. He set Olympic records at the Paralympic records at the 100, 200, 400 meter sprints, right? And his nickname is the Blade Runner, and the fastest man on no legs. He doesn't like that one much, but it's going to be interesting to see. Because an appeals court overturned the International Association of Athletic Federations ruling that said he can't compete with these artificial legs. So it's a great story, and I have no idea if he actually gets an advantage from it. They're saying he doesn't. We've got a couple of disasters we're dealing with in the world, and so I'm going to turn to international events here for a little while. But before I do that, I want to move on to a little bit of music from Pete Townsend, who's celebrating his, I think it's his 63rd birthday today.
listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is May 19th. And it was on May 19th that Dan Quayle criticized Murphy Brown, or really the sitcom Murphy Brown, because its title character had a child out of wedlock. And, of course, well, think about the year that this happened, folks. My audience is pretty smart. What year would this have happened? Murphy Brown was on, and Dan Quayle was the vice president of the United States. That should give you a hint. It was 1992. And, of course, he was talking to values voters, or, and I hate that term because there's plenty of values on both sides of the political spectrum, but he was talking to religious conservative voters primarily. And what I think happens with folks is that they get a little carried away at times. So what the thing that was funny with Quayle was basically he was picking a fight with an a fake character. It wasn't a real person. Murphy Brown's not a real person. So you criticize Murphy Brown, you open yourself up to ridicule. It's like, I remember seeing this comedian once. I was tending bar at a hotel, and the comedian came in for this conference. I was the bartender. The comedian came in. He came back and had a drink and sat around talking to me while they had their meeting. And he was a ventriloquist. So part of his act was he had a dummy with him that he carried around. And in the middle of his show, a very common thing for some ventriloquist is when a heckler starts in, and they often do, it's easy to handle him. You have the dummy have the conversation with the heckler. And at some point, you use the line, "Oh, yeah? Well, who's working your mouth?" And it always gets a big laugh because it's absurd to pick a fight with a dummy, a non-real person. Those words really aren't coming out of that dummy's mouth. Well, it's the same with Murphy Brown. Candace Bergen is not really Murphy Brown. So Quayle was at a disadvantage, although he made his point and won his battles with conservatives. But I just thought that was interesting. Also, in 1964, the State Department reported that diplomats had found 40 microphones planted in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. That was back in the days when you could find them planted. We built a new embassy in Russia, or in the Soviet Union, in the 80s, and we never moved into it. The Russians did the construction, and they planted in the cement, in the building, in a variety of ways, very sophisticated technology. The place was totally bugged. There was no way to salvage it. It was so embedded in it. You couldn't just find the microphones and remove them. They were cemented into walls and wall, you know, just all over the place. Well, since then, we made a change, in part for terrorist issues, but also primarily because of these kinds of shenanigans on the part of the Soviet Union. And now, any embassy we build anywhere in the world, we ship all the supplies, lock, stock, and barrel, as they say, from the U.S. and have it built over there. So we know where everything comes from. We don't trust them to supply any of the materials in the country where we're building it. And we also have our own construction crews build it. And the specs are up to, you know, withstanding bombing. So there's special glass, special everything. So things have changed quite a bit when it comes to how we put together our embassies. So I said we were going to talk about two things. One is the cyclone that hit Burma, and the other one is the quake that hit China. The two are a contrast in styles because basically what happened was China has been relatively open about their earthquake. Now, they've lost somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 people by the time this is all done, and 5 million people have been displaced or made homeless. Whole towns, the buildings collapsed in them. So it's a huge mess, and China's a big country. They got over 1.6 billion people, and they can handle it. But what's interesting is if you compare it with the big quake of like 1976, this was back in the days when Nixon had just opened the door to China. they were very secretive. They didn't want foreign journalists in. They didn't want their journalists covering it. It was kept under tight wraps, and they wanted the world not to know that this had gone wrong. By contrast, although their tendency is to try and be secretive and cover some of this stuff up, by contrast, in fact, China has been quite open in this one. And it won't be long before there's criticism. That is, some government buildings were left standing while some schools collapsed and their roofs crushed children. So the question is, gee, why are you building quake-proof buildings for government employees but not for children? Of course, it could be just older buildings, whatever. But there will come questions. Their journalists will ask tough questions. But right now, China's being relatively open about it, and they're accepting aid from other countries, although they can handle much of it themselves. Not so the situation in Burma. So this is almost it's more than 2 weeks old, or maybe it was 2 weeks tomorrow that it happened. I forget the exact date. But the death toll has been jumped up as of last weekend, this past weekend, to over 78,000 people. Now, they had been working on a death toll much lower than that just 3-4 days ago, but experts have suspected that they lost many more lives than they were seeing. And the problem is it's going to get worse. So what Burma is, a military junta, a group of strongmen, military folks that have ruled Burma with an iron fist for, I don't know, 30 or more years. They renamed the country Myanmar. It's why you hear the conflicting advice. That's what they want to call it, because we don't recognize them as a legitimate government. U.S. and other Western allies still refer to it as Burma. And the Burmese people suffer mightily under them. Now, it's interesting, of course, that it comes to light only when a disaster happens, because theoretically the the U.S. administration's democracy agenda should be equally interested in having democracy in Burma as it is in having democracy in Iraq or any other country. But, of course, Burma's not sitting on a pile of oil, and it's not in as strategic a location, so we don't worry about it as much naturally. Anyway, Burmese officials, the military junta, did not want to let people in. So we had aid workers. We had supplies. And they said, drop them off here on the docks and we'll take care of them. We got enough help. Well, they didn't want foreign aid workers in there, making it look like they couldn't handle their own problems. So I think the U.S. Sent, the U.S. and the U.N. and other countries sent in one or two shipments. They were seized by the military and the World Food Program, or the relief effort, halted. And they said, we're not sending you anymore if you're going to seize it. And so slowly, the Burmese officials have allowed more food in, more help, but they haven't really opened the spigot. They've been denying visas. Aid workers need visas to get in. They just went a week or more without issuing them. So the problem here is that health experts know that this cyclone has left people without fresh water and without potable water, that is water they can drink, and some food and relief and some medical supplies for people who are injured. They got a serious crisis on their hands. It won't be simply the 78,000 that died in the initial cyclone and its immediate aftermath. We are headed here for a period of disease, and without fresh water, serious cases of diarrhea that can lead to other disease and death. So people are talking this could be anywhere from 100,000 to over 1 million dead. 1.5 million dead by the time we're done, mostly because Burmese officials are more interested in clinging to power, making sure they keep a tight lid on the country, than they are in helping their citizens. And what bugs me about when I read a story like this, same when Sudan didn't want to let us in to deal with Darfur, when Ethiopia had a famine, but they were starving certain segments of their population, so they weren't interested in UN or US aid getting through. I don't understand why we don't bomb these countries with grain, with water, with whatever supplies they need. Right? We are willing to go around the UN to drop bombs on somebody, but we don't seem willing to go around the UN to drop food. And could you imagine the PR coup if the United States was accused by Burma of violating its airspace and its sovereignty. And China comes to its rescue and says, the United States shouldn't be doing this. And the people of the world say, well, what are they doing? They're bombing us with food. They're dropping food and medical supplies and water in remote regions so people can take care of themselves. Now, would some people try and hoard it and then sell it? Yes, that's likely to happen. But it just isn't there at any price or for any purpose right now. If we get 100 million gallons of water in there, if we get 100 million pounds of food in there, I don't care if some people hoard it and some people sell it. It'll be on the ground helping people. But we don't seem to have the courage to do that. Anyway, that's all I'll say about the situation in Burma and the situation in China. And when we come back, we will talk about a whole nother situation, that is the situation in Iraq.